Share. Howdy, folks. This is Scott Parker, and you're listening to episode number 13 of the ZappaCast for September 2013. At the top of the show, you heard the track Redunzel from the You Can't Do That on Stage Anymore Volume 2 album, recorded live in Helsinki, Finland in 1974. We played that as a tribute to the late, great George Duke, who passed away during the making of this episode, and in our next episode, number 14, we're going to have a much more extensive tribute to the man. That's coming your way very shortly. In this episode, the Reverend Andrew Greenaway and myself will be chatting with composer, musician, and bon vivant, Nige Lennon, and her musical partner, the great John Tobacco. Nige has just released a newly remastered version of her album, Reinventing the Wheel, which came out originally in 2001. It's got a lot of bonus material on it, and we'll be hearing some selections from that album during the course of this episode. As you can hear, a good time was had by all. So without any further ado, here is our conversation with Nige Lennon and John Tobacco right here on the ZappaCast.
Well, folks, we're here with our roundtable discussion, and this time we have a couple of very special guests to the ZappaCast. We have the one and only, live from Long Island, directly from her heart to you, musician, composer, and producer, Miss Nige Lennon. Hello, Nige.
Hey, boys. Really pleased to be here with you today.
And to Nige's right or left?
His left. My left, actually.
It's your left.
You're right.
Her co-conspirator, a very wonderful composer, songwriter, producer, engineer, and recording artist, Mr. John Tobacco. Hello, John.
Hi, how you doing, guys?
And the other thing you have to say about John, one of the greatest sets of pipes in the history of vocal music. I will add that. You may cringe.
Don't get too crazy.
Anyway, hyperboles will flow. Yeah.
Yes. Anyway. Let them flow.
Let the hyperboles flow. Boy, I'm the one who's having drinks here. Man.
Imagine
John's
having to try to edit this. This is a nightmare trying to edit this. Let it go, man.
Yeah, right.
I just let it go. That's fine. And of course, in the black corner over there, live from England, the idiot.
Are you alive, Andrew?
What?
Is he alive? Really? Okay, Andrew, talk to us.
Hello, boys and girls.
The Reverend Andrew Greenaway. How are you over there? You're getting ready for the proms?
I'm getting ready for the proms, yeah. And for Zappanali.
Tell us about that.
You've got a date for the proms, do you?
Yes, my good friend Uncle Ian.
Carlos Dean. There you go. Wait, never mind.
Well, in case you're all out there in podcast land wondering what we're all doing here.
Can I use the F word?
Yeah.
Okay. What the fuck we're talking
about?
They'll
let you know when you can't.
Okay. Just bleep me, man. Bleep me.
More exciting that way.
It is.
It's really an excellent question, actually. We're here to talk about the reissue of an album that came out, is it 13 years ago? Really, now?
104 years. But who's counting? It's like, look at the Mayan calendar. Yeah, it was like 2000, 2001. But like I said, yeah. We recorded it primarily in 1999. It was we kind of mixed it, mastered it, got it ready to go, and the release date was 2000, but because I wanted to make it look a little newer, we put 2001 as the copyright date.
And also, in case you folks are wondering out there what is happening and why Nige has graciously consented to finally do our podcast, she is re-releasing Reinventing the Wheel.
Ta-da!
Ta-da! In a completely remastered form.
Oh, God, John has done wonders with that. He's done new masters of all the tracks. There are the three original demos I did in 1996, which are all me primarily, and sort of a bass player who shall remain unnamed. And it's just basically me and some vocalists. I did those for Reinhard Preuss of Muffin Records, who was he was waiving a contract. Is there a dog? Do I hear ARF in the background? Is there an ARF in the background?
Not for me.
I just heard an ARF. Anyway, maybe that's just...
I'm from England.
Yeah, okay. But anywho, so, I did these demos in 1997. That's the earliest material that is now included on the re-release because they are part of the whole project. Mm. And John had signed with Muffin Records previously. Yeah. In what years?
And that was 1996.
Right.
And unfortunately, the music was never released because they ran into some financial problems.
Right.
But I had remastered the records like three or four times. Yeah. So by the time he told me, forget about it, we can't do it, I mean, I just said, you know, whatever, I'll do it myself eventually. So
that was funny. And so, you know, John and I, to go back a little bit, John sent me a bunch of his music by mail when I was living in L.A., 1996. Early 96,
yeah,
I believe. And he said, you know, hey, I don't know if you're going to like this. I've read your book, Being Frank, which is, ladies and gentlemen, http://airstreambooks.net.
Being Frank.
It's a cool book. Plug, plug, plug. But anyway, John had read my book about, you know, my experiences with Frank Zappa, and he liked it. And he thought maybe I would like his music for a very strange reason, which was that both of us had worked with these high tape recorders, these very poor quality Asian reel-to-reel tape recorders at a certain point. And he read that in my book, and he said, I did that too. We're both losers. We've got to have something in common musically. And he was right, though. I loved his music. I listened to this stuff, and I said, I don't know who the hell you are, but why aren't you making millions of dollars? You should be on the radio, son. And I felt really bad because I couldn't help him at the time. I mean, I called him. It was funny. He sounded horrified when I called him up at the recording studio where he was working and living at that time, and I said, I want to speak to John Tobacco. And he said, uh-oh, it's a bill collector.
Clearly.
Or something. I don't know. And when I got him on the phone, he was like, he's a little horrified and frightened. And I said, no, look, I love your music. I think you're the greatest thing since sliced whatever, but why don't you have a record deal? And he says, you know, I've been wondering about that myself. So anyway, flash forward a little bit. He got the deal with Muffin Records. We kept in contact. We became good friends. And he got the deal with Muffin Records, and he said, well, what about you? You've got some music you can do, too, as well. And I said, well, I suppose. And, you know, I was pretty active in the L.A., what do you call it, the punk roots, rockabilly, punkabilly, psychobilly music scene, probably in the 90s, 80s and 90s.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I played every toilet in L.A. I opened for everybody from the Blasters to X to, you know, everybody.
That was you.
That was me. I'm sorry. And, you know, I played punk. I played new wave. I didn't try to play new wave, but sometimes you have to do what you have to do. But the funniest thing about that, God, I digress all over the place here, but I took this.
Slow down.
Slow down? The safety's off, you know?
The safety
anyway,
is off.
Anyway, I had a really funny thing vis-a-vis that in the 80s. I did this album called The Surreal McCoy. Mm-hmm. A bunch of like walk wounded, you know, punk burnout musicians. They were really great, actually, but they were horrible too. And I beat them into, you know, submission. I made them into a rhythm section. And we did this demo, which, you know, series of demos, like eight songs, really pretty good, called The Surreal McCoy. John's heard it. Makes him sick, but we love John anyway. But anyway, it was we did this thing, you know, and it was so funny because we took it. The lead singer was this guy from Texas, Tex Teardrop. He was this one-eyed wacko. He really was very much like a pirate, which we'll get into later.
Yeah, I was just going to say, we've got a pirate question later.
I'm afraid you do, yes. And he said, you know, hey, I know T-Bone Burnett, the producer. Now, put a bunch of asterisks around T-Bone Burnett, the producer.
Mm-hmm.
And going to take, you know, let's go talk to him about this project. Okay, fine. You know, this is like 1986, 87. We go talk to Bob Burnett, the producer. He'd listen to maybe 30 seconds of each track or something, and he said, he had this Texas drawl. He says, and it's totally phony, of course. It's like John Wayne or something. He says, you know what? You know what, guys? I got to tell you, Roots music is dead. One of the funniest moments before. Anyway, so much for that. Fast forward, anyway, back to where we're talking about with John and Muffin Records. And I said, well, okay, let's try and do this. And luckily, it's kind of funny because here we are dealing with Reinhard Preuss, the guy from Muffin Records, who,
yep,
of course, Muffin, is, as always, has been based in Austin, Texas. Well, look, I like Austin, Texas. I mean, you know, my uncle was a fiddle player. I love that kind of music and stuff. But really, is Austin, Texas the center of the musical universe? I'm going, well, okay. So anyway, make a long story boring, Reinhard signed me to Muffin, along with John. And we found ourselves kind of, John's going, we can't do this stuff. You're in L.A., I'm in New York. I'm going, John, I can do it. No, John, I love John because he's the original Doubting Thomas. If you tell John something, he's going to go, no, it can't be done. He'll have a panic attack. He's going to say, no, it can't be done. And then, 5 minutes later, he's going to go, you know what? I know exactly how we can do this. And he'll do the most brilliant job anybody's ever done in their life.
Mm.
That's John, man. It's just so cool to have people like this in your life. It is very cool. Anyway, so.
Is he the yang to your yin, as it were?
Oh, very much so. Wouldn't you say that?
It's separate people, so
but we meet in the middle a lot. I was telling somebody on the phone, a dear old friend of mine, probably my sister from 35 years ago, telling her the other day, she was asking about John because she's saying she liked what I had done with John musically, and I said, you know what, John and I are like an old married couple. We bicker and we fight. We come to a kind of term sometimes and we're like, and inevitably, it always works out. And here we are.
We don't normally fight.
We don't fight. We disagree, though. Both of us are pretty slick.
Humans,
We're pretty slick at disagreeing.
We have different backgrounds,
we try to be reasonable
about stuff.
But it's just like John is, not to get all.
Sometimes it's good to say, no, I can't do it, but in the back of my head, I'm thinking, like, well, maybe I could do it. Like, I need to test the water. How important it really is for me to do it.
Yeah,
like,
John is much
more. I can't. Remastered, what do you think? I can't do anything. We have no tracks.
Right. John's much more cautious than I am.
Yeah, I'm a little bit more cautious.
A lot more cautious. And I'm just saying, hey, go for broke, man. The safety's off. Let it rip.
Yep.
But we work really well together that way. I have never worked with anybody that has given me as much pleasure as working with John.
Thank you.
No, really, absolutely. And, anyway.
Well, the stuff makes sense,
John.
But it's an EPI connection.
Yeah, I think that's what it is.
It's the fact that we really learn to do a lot with nothing.
Plus, we like certain groups we like.
That's true.
So we have a familiar background.
It's also kind of, we were both surrealists.
Yeah.
We both believe the only reality kind of tends to be absurdity.
There's no question.
And, it really makes a big difference. So anyway, moving forward, we did, we worked together on Reinventing the Wheel. It was a very strange time for me because we started working on it in 97 after the demo. And John, I just basically said, here's a bunch of stuff I've done already. See what you think of these tracks. And I had this provisional record contract going already. And John's listening to this stuff I'm sending him on crappy cassettes. he's going, well, what can I do with this? I could sort of sense across the continent. He's going, oh my God, what garbage. What am I going to do with this? SHIT.
I never thought of
no,
it.
No, you
like
didn't.
That,
you no. didn't. But I could see you had a lot of. What do I have to work with here? Yeah. What do you have to work with? And what I was really impressed by, I sent him very basic demos, many of them. And he started to send me back these things that were so fully blown, they were beautiful. And I'm going, oh, this is really great stuff. And so, we began to work back and forth and back and forth. And gradually, it became obvious to both of us we're going to have to get into the studio together at about the same time, or we're going to have problems. So that was what we did. But at that point, something intervened with me. I got cancer, and I was given a death sentence, basically. They gave me like 9 months to live. And I said, well, no, I got too many scores to settle, too many people I'm really pissed off at. And I got this album to make. And, it's like I said, it ain't going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
So I went in, I had surgery, I had radiation treatments, and I was off for 6 months, I guess, almost a year.
Yeah, it was a while,
It was a while. And
I was very surprised, but not surprised. You guys don't know the history of my music and stuff.
How many
times and deals and things have gotten let down. And so I was like, oh, that's just great, because we started it, and now she has cancer, and I just felt like, that's why I'm always a little hesitant to communicate. It was horrible.
It was
I was very upset about that, and this is one of the few times where things turned around. We actually were able to make it work. So I'm glad it kind of broke that.
Had no doubt.
It was bad luck, but
that's why in the the credits to the album, the old ones and the new ones, I have chronological defiance. As part of my arsenal of things I did on the album. I beat it. I'm 15 years now, 16 years cancer free, and the healthiest heck. And I got to lose about 15 pounds, so I'm doing all right.
I think I found your 15 pounds, actually.
You know what it is? We're all really good people. We like to eat and we like to drink. You know, I think that's what it is. And hey, life's life. It's worth living, but only if you live it well. Anyway.
Yeah, Andrew does actually enjoys a pint, don't you, Dan?
Yeah, occasionally.
What's your favorite? What's your favorite, Andrew? What do you like to drink? What kind of beer? Stout, ale, what?
Yeah, I do like some of the real ales that we have over here. I'm not sure I've got a favorite. Where I work, we've got a whole selection of them, and I'm
what a great job!
I'm working my way through.
Woo! Yeah.
Yeah, but I suppose. Yeah, Newcastle Brown Ale is a favorite as well.
Mm, yeah. Oh, we can get that over here.
Yeah.
Yeah, we can. I like that too.
You mentioned that John had done a lot of work on the tracks, remastering or anything. I just wondered why you decided to come up with a new track running order on the...
Well, that was the decision of Reinhard Preuss.
Ah, okay.
You wanted to have some input on it. Probably.
Well, it's like, we got these runaway geniuses. We got to put a brake on them somehow. But he really had a great... At first I'm going, you're not going to mess with what we've done. But truthfully, we had all this stuff to juggle. And when you're dealing with digital downloads, they aren't really any particular order. But he wanted to have it running order. He was still thinking of it like a physical CD in a way. There's 21 tracks as opposed to... What were there on the original one? There's five less. Anyway... So, you know, but he did this beautiful job. I mean, I'm so impressed by his running order, what he did. There's about three elements he used. Subject matter, stylistic stuff, keys, well, maybe four. And also geography. He uses a lot of geography on it. He goes kind of from, because the songs on the album have a lot to, they start in L.A., they kind of go down to Mexico in a way, like Calle Sin Nombre.
They always do.
Yeah, they always go south. Yeah. And then, you know, it goes on from there. But he really has this interesting, like a very European sense of you know, the geography of thought. He's a really interesting guy, I'll tell you. And so when he sent me the running order that he had in mind and I heard it, I thought, okay, I was ready to chew him a new asshole. Because I really don't like people messing with my ideas, except for John. He's allowed any time. But, you know, it was like, okay, but really. And when I heard it, I thought, oh, this is absolutely brilliant. And so he came up with that idea, and I can't be more pleased with it. I love it. It's great.
But where does Reinhard come from? I thought he was from Germany. I thought he lived in Germany.
He is from Germany. He's from Offenburg. From the Black Forest, the Schwarzwald.
When Muffin Records started, I assumed they were based in Germany, but obviously not.
Yeah, Offenburg. It's Offenburg. Or Altenburg, is it? No, it's Offenburg. I'm sorry.
When did he move to Austin, then?
I believe... 20-some years ago?
Yeah, 94, maybe.
94, yeah. He was, he had a very, I can't really speak for him, but it's my understanding he had many, many very strong connections to big, you know, he was part of the Bertelsmann group, you know, the BMG. And when John and I signed with Muffin, I mean, we looked at the list of distribution outlets he had, and we both went, oh my God, we've hit the big time. We didn't know what to make of it. It was incredible. So, you know, it's just an amazing thing. He's, you know, he's really had this, but, you know, I'm not really sure what happened exactly, but he did run into some issues with people that weren't as scrupulous as they could have been. And, you know, some of the musicians, perhaps, that he had offered very generous contracts, who had sold things before, many copies. He had some platinum albums. He was making money hand over fist. I mean, I'll tell you right now, the contract that he offered me, I don't know about you, but... But the contract that he offered me and that I signed would have really kept me pretty happy for a long time once I delivered those masters to him.
Yeah, he gave me pretty much free reign.
Yeah, absolutely.
Basically, he wanted to get his money back and
right.
stuff.
Right, and then everything else
we
was
had
yours.
All the royalties and publishing right. was all ours. It was great.
Oh, he's a great guy. I mean, you can't say enough of that. And he loves musicians and he wants to help them.
Yeah, Bruce Fowler liked him a lot. He really liked Ryan.
But it's just the problem is when you do that, I guess it's just, you know, you got to make a living somehow. And people take advantage of that, and I'm really sorry.
And he's going to put people on tour.
Yeah.
Well, that's what he wants to do. Yeah, he wants. That would have been very cool. We would have had a lot of mothers to play some of our stuff.
Oh, yeah,
it would
absolutely.
Have been really interesting.
And he, you know, yeah, so he's just a wonderful impresario in the best sense of that word. And, you know, I don't like people with record companies. I don't like record companies generally, but, you know, I would have to say this is the one guy I can sign with without really thinking about it too much.
Okay, the next obvious question.
Yeah.
Whose idea was it to include Candy Zappa and Mike Keneally, and how did you get them in board?
Oh, yeah. Well, okay, as far as Candy, she contacted me out of the blue after my book, Being Frank, my time with Frank Zappa was published. It was probably, I would think, 95? Maybe 96. Yeah. I really think sort of 96 seemed to be that locus. And she just called me on the phone one day and left me a message on my answering machine. I'm listening to this voice. She says, "This is Candy Zappa. I'm Frank's sister." I'm listening to the voice and I'm going, "This is Frank's voice, sped up to 78 RPM. Or 45.
Yeah, 45.
More like 45. It wasn't that much higher. The inflection was there. The intonation was there. The timbre was there. And I'm like, "This is really interesting. I read your book," she said, "and I really like it a lot, and I'd like to meet you." So I said, "Okay, great." And we got together. We went out. She was living in North Carolina. And my then husband, Lionel Rolf, and I went out and had dinner with her. She made us a nice lasagna dinner, nice Italian dinner, right? We sat and talked about stuff. And she said, "You know, you're doing music again?" And I said, "Well, I'm getting back into it, yeah." And she said, "Well, I'd really love to maybe contribute something." And I said, "Great. What do you do?" "I sing." "Okay." And she gave me some demos she'd done, and I'm going, "This woman's the world's greatest white blues singer. Holy, you know, holy snot." And so, you know, one thing led to another, and she did those demos for me, the ones that are now on Reinventing the Wheel Reinvented. We did those in 97 in a very strange environment, too. It was this guy that somehow had been a neighbor of mine in a building I lived in Silver Lake, which is the sort of the equivalent of Williamsburg in Brooklyn. But it isn't as classy. It doesn't have Brooklyn's history behind it, but it was L.A. It was the best L.A. could do at the time. And all these sort of pseudo musicians, wannabes, were there. And so this guy, I'm not going to give his name because he doesn't deserve to be named, said, "Oh, boy, you've got a record deal?" Because this was at a time when things were really changing a lot. Nobody had a record deal. You're just this punk band. You know, you're doing all these crappy gigs and clubs, and you're releasing cassettes of your music and going, "I got to sell this stuff. I got to do it." Anyway, he goes, "You've got a record deal? Wow. Candy." My parrot just gave that one high fives. She likes it. Anyway.
She's on the record.
So, yeah, she is on the record. But, I went and this guy had an Atari game computer, and he had very primitive songwriting, you know, music software on it. I don't remember what the program even was. It might have been like an early version of Cubase or was something. It was a piece of crap. Was it Cubase? I thought maybe. And so I had all these old things I've been doing and laid them all down. And then I got Candy came in and sang. I had been doing this reggae version of Any Way the Wind Blows. I always thought that should be a reggae song.
Yep.
Of course, you know, in an item like commerciality, I always thought it also should be sung in a language other than English, preferably one nobody knew. Because it just has this funny kind of flow to it. And I had invented a language, almost like Esperanto. But anyway, that's another story. We did it in English. And Candy had done demos of that song for Frank when she was in her teens, very early teens, when he'd written it. And so she knew the song intimately. And she, the thing that really blew me away, she's, you know, this is like this guy's really crummy little home bedroom studio. And picture this. It's an Atari game computer. This little thing. This little, like, 12-inch screen, right? It's a crappy little box. The guy, this Lee's, he had porn videos of Pamela Anderson Lee as a screensaver. Just, you know, I remember how she gave up. Well, you know, we won't go into that.
Yeah.
But that pop up. You know, there was a major latency issue with these tracks. They'd come up. Uh-oh. Everything's slow. Suddenly, there you'd see Pamela having a good old time. So it was just very surreal. But Candy came in, and under these really peculiar circumstances, laid down these beautiful vocals. And she did the main vocal. And then she said, "I got backups for this." I go, "Oh, you do? Well, let's." And I figured, well, we'll see how that goes. Because a lot of people do backups, myself included, and they suck, you know. And I didn't know her that well at the time. If I'd known better, I would never have thought that. But she proceeded to lay down these three vocals, these backup vocals, and they were, I'm listening because she's singing into the headphones, and I couldn't hear the whole thing as a totality, but I'm listening to her sing this, and I'm going, "My God, this isn't going to work. That's going to be like, this is going to be the worst train wreck, you know, since, you know, whatever the heck that was."
What was that?
Anyway, I can't
think of it.
The Great Train Wreck. Well, the Great Train Robbery, but I was thinking of that one that, you know, the Marley Bone wreck. In New York in like 1918. It's going to be the worst. I had to think of the name. Anyway, it's either going to, I'm sorry about this. Anyway, it's either going to be worst train wreck in history. This is going to be beautiful. And sure enough, she put those tracks together and my spine turned to ice water. I thought it was just so beautiful. So there you go. And she did that. And then she added many other things. We did Messing in the Kitchen as a demo. which I've been doing with my sort of pseudo-punkish new wave roots, you know, band as a piece of crap. And she really turned that into something. We did a great job with that, and it was very surreal. We added a lot of weird effects. And then she finally finished up with the wife don't like it, but that wasn't on the demos. But anyway, she did such a great job. And I said, hey, this is a person I would like to continue to work with. And we had a lot of other things in common. She introduced me to her mother, Frank's mother also, Rosemarie Zappa, sweetest lady you ever want to meet in your life. God bless her. May she rest in peace. Loved her. Just loved her. And so I just feel like, it's been a lot of years for me. You know, I hadn't been in touch with Frank, obviously, since before he passed. And I just felt like, well, I'm being reunited with this family. You know, it was a really good feeling. It really was.
Status of your relationship with Candy these days? Are you still...
Well, I haven't heard from her much. I don't think she's... I mean, God bless. I don't think she's doing so well. I think she's out there in L.A. kind of fading away. And, you know, she's been very supportive of Nolan Porter, her husband, and his career. Now, I believe Andrew, they've been back there with Andrew. With Nolan.
Yeah, they played over there a couple of times.
And played there because he does that Northern Soul kind of thing, and he had many hits in the '60s. And
he played in Canada.
Canada, right? I heard that.
Yeah.
And he's really, you know, he's a great singer. He's a great guy. He was actually responsible for, actually, from what I understand, getting the musicians of Little Feat together. Yeah. Right. You know, because they backed him up on his debut album. And yeah, really great. I don't know. I don't know what she's up to, and I love her dearly. I love her like a sister, and just hope all is well. I don't know. Heard much.
Jimmy Carl Black came some involvement in. That's because he was playing with Nolan, and then I think he went off and formed Geronimo Black, and so the Little Feat drummer, whose name escapes me.
Yeah, but that was Richie Hayward.
Richie Hayward.
Yeah, he came and took over. And that's where, obviously, Estrada and Lowell George were there, so yeah. Okay, and Mr. Keneally.
Mr. Keneally. John, take it from there.
Well, I heard Mike Keneally's music probably back in 1993. I think that's when he put out Hat,
yep.
Record. And I liked it. I know I've been doing music like that and got in contact with him at one point and wanted to see if he'd be interested in playing. I think it was going to be on your record.
It was. Right? Yeah. What happened, John wanted him on the record because we had done just a black guitar. We were working on that song. And I'm not that kind of a guitar player by any, you know, stretch of the imagination. We needed somebody who could really, you know, strangle. And John thought Keneally would be perfect for that.
Yeah, so I wrote a couple of parts out of him. I thought that'd be kind of fun. And
then my friend David Wally, the guy who wrote No Commercial Potential, the first FZ biography, was living in Maine then. And he went to a gig that Mike was playing in New Hampshire, Portsmouth, which is right next to where he lived in Maine. And he walked up to Keneally on the bandstand after probably between sets and said, "You're going to play on Nigel's record." Keneally looked at him and said, "Huh? What? What are you talking about? This guy's crazy. Throw him out of the club." But they had sort of a chat about it, and he convinced Keneally he should do this. And so John got hold of Keneally, and, you know, various things happened. And he did show up at the studio. He was a bit late.
Yeah, we're running out of time.
We were running out of time because it was this studio.
It's a situation where they drop you off in a studio and they say go.
Yeah.
And I'm like, but there's no one here to help me. I don't know where you're. What's going on?
It was
here.
A bizarre studio too, because
so you hold your breath and you try to picture your mind a studio that you're used to working with, but similar to the studios. And so I managed to get things to work somehow. And
John did a brilliant job because
it was easy to do the work with Candy because she sang so well, we had no problem getting her to finish the parts. Mm-hmm. We were running out of time, and Mike was very late, and I was thinking, it's not going to happen.
Yeah.
So depressing. I'm here in Los Angeles. I really like to at least meet him.
At least see him.
I wrote these parts out for him, and he's kind of cool if he can play it.
Yeah.
And at the last moment, he did show up. I guess he said he was in traffic.
He said caught in traffic. Yeah. But the thing is, like saying you get
but
caught. Yeah.
I think the thing that was kind of interesting is that he walked in, and I don't know what he thought, but I actually presented him with some music, written music.
And
all of a sudden he thought, uh-oh, this is like kind of serious, because like actually got some music to him specifically. And it was funny. I saw him, he was like kind of warming up. He was playing a little bit of the Kinder's Arf on the guitar.
I remember that.
Pretty good. So I showed him the music. He was like, oh, okay. And he kind of looked at it. He played it a little bit. And then I let the thing roll on the computer, and he was able to nail it quickly.
Mm-hmm.
And then we just had him play like a bunch of stuff and just wanted him to have a good time. But, you know, obviously you could show off some of your guitar skills. But it was a very interesting moment there because you're working with someone who you've listened to and you know is really, really good. And then you listen and you're trying to get him to play stuff. And he's like looking at you like he's like, I'm not sure what I should do. And I'm like, well, you're Mike Keneally.
Come
up with stuff, you know?
Hey, come on, man.
So it was a little tense for
maybe
a few
seconds.
Maybe
he needed to have the hand signals down.
I think I didn't give him any hand signals.
Yeah, right. You know.
So anyway, the good thing about it is Mike can play a lot of things. I had him play a whole bunch of stuff. And I said, when I go home, I'll just edit the whole thing and we'll make something up out of it.
Where everything is dead, the kids need a religion to feed an empty head. At midnight in their bedrooms, be sure the door is locked.
kneel down before those speakers and worship at the Rock. It's just £5 of plastic with the finish painted black. Six strings, a bridge, and tuner. Some knuckle-walking hero just sent him to the stars. This ain't no holy relic. It's just a black guitar. Up there in the schoolroom, nobody seems to care. Down there on the corner, dealers everywhere. But Promo Joe the Hackman has got a Jones to sell. He's working for the company and he'll send you straight to hell. With just £5 of plastic with a finish painted black. Six strings, a bridge, and tuner. Some knuckle-walking hero just send him to the stars. This ain't no holy relic. It's just a bad guitar.
Mr. Keneally, you're wanted in the guitar department. Mike Keneally, guitar department.
After professors will convene to lie about the future and tell us where we've been. They'll talk about the culture, they'll swoon about the gold, they'll drool about those good old days when we had some heart and soul. It was a revolution, it was the best by far, it was a golden moment. £5 of plastic with a finish painted black. Six strings, a bridge, and tuner. Some knuckle-walking hero just sent him to the stars. This ain't no holy relic, it's just black. With a finish painted black. Six strings, a bridge, and tuner. Some knuckle-walking hero just sent him to the stars. This ain't no holy relic, it's just a black guitar. A black.
Nigel also got him to recite some, would you call it?
Little vocals.
Some vocals and stuff.
We had a song. We had a song, "The Pirates of Old Northport."
Yeah, is that Keneally doing the Magdalena verse?
Yeah. Oh, the Magdalena. Yes. You sound like Tom Waits. Right?
Yeah.
I was trying to get him to do sort of the Johnny Cash thing, but we had to really kind of seduce him because he's saying, "I can't do that again. I can't do that again." But gradually, he kind of worked into it. He started with the Tom Waits thing on the Pirates of Old Northport. By the time we got to Mesmerized Cowboy, there's these little vocal interjections. Don't you milk my elephant or I'll bite you in the eye. You know, he did that stuff. And it was almost his Johnny Cash voice.
Mm.
So,
talking of that
a
song,
few beers. We gave him a few beers. They did help.
There's another Zappa connection on that song, isn't there?
There's a couple of quotes.
A bunch of them, but it was the lyrics were written by Irvin Guerder, who is a real hardcore Dadaist in Zurich, Switzerland. And Irvin, all through the 70s, was Frank Zappa's archivist and publicist in that part of Europe. He's based out of Zurich and that part of Switzerland, but that, of course, goes into Italy, it goes into Germany, it goes into France. And so he was very, very tired. tireless in promoting Frank and helping him sell tickets and albums in Europe. And he just adored Frank. I mean, he just was his biggest supporter. And that was how I met him. Ruth Underwood introduced me to him via mail, because I wasn't in Europe at the time. It was, we were in L.A. And she said, you really, you know, you like this language crap, and you're, you know, you're full of crap word-wise, and you're always making puns nobody understands. We know this other lunatic in Zurich who you might be able to get along with. And sure enough, man, it's like Dada, man. Ooh. But anyway, so I became friends with Urban, and, you know, we maintained friendship over, you know, several decades. And, you know, one day I said, you know, he had sent me a, he did a book in late 90s, early aughts. I can't remember the exact dates. It's in The Sign of the Magic Monkey, under the Zeichen der Magische Affen. And it's a really great book. It's his whole history of, he's a really interesting guy because he's a real link to beat and Dada history and rock and roll history and popular culture in many ways in Europe. And he did this incredible book, and there's this, he had lyrics in there called Mesmerized Cowboy, and I said, I really like this because my background is in cattle ranching. My family basically were cattle ranchers. They came from the part of Arizona, the only part of Arizona where there was a lot of that going on at the turn of the century. They lost everything at that point because of the, you know, there was a big economic downturn, and they had to go into mining and other things. But I have this sort of feel. My uncle was an old-time fiddler, and a lot of the music I really love is old-time music. And I really have this feeling about, because I, at the same time I went over to Europe when I was, you know, in my late teens, early 20s, I fell in love with European culture, the absurdist stuff. But I still had this weird kind of rural thing. When Frank did Montana, that song came so close to expressing something that is me in a weird way. Mm-hmm. It's this brilliant kind of synthesis of Dada and absurdity and the Old West and how absurd it all is. And anyway, Urban had written the song, Mesmerized Cowboy, and it was absolutely great, the lyrics. You know, he hadn't written the music. And I said, I want to do this song. And he said, wow, this would be great. So that was what I did. And, you know, I don't know how well it turned out, but I kind of like some elements of it because of what it means to me. And I think what it means, maybe in a way, to Frank and to history and to Dada and surrealism and, you know, the fact that, you know, it's all sort of part of the process. It's what I'm always trying to do with my music. So.
Many a generation on this here hot air balloon. Some turn Xerox, some go mad. It's one plastic saloon, partner. But here comes Poco from the hills, riding his dead horse. Dada, he calls it, and also says,
never strangle in the dark, 'cause you might get the wrong.
His morals are all right. Instead of marshmallows, he swallows his albino beanie. That's why he sees so clear.
I love to fulminate against the universe.
Now Poco, he knows about anarchy. Not everybody's got the head to wear old hats like that. They ask him where he's coming from. He just cranks on his song.
Oh me, oh my, my cow, oh boy, has just turned green. So if you wanna dance with me, take off your ready-made glance. One cheap western, one cheap flick. Albino beans will be the kick.
Here, let me finish picking my nose. Bwah.
But then again, he blows the show. His cowbell's out of tune. And paranoia strikes poor Poco down. When someone tells him straight that life ain't run on dreams. His final words to be remembered.
Don't you milk my elephant, or I'll bite you in the eye.
which only goes to prove that pataphysics never die as long as there is green.
It's a dinghy, damn it!
The new running order, that one precedes the Candy and Jimmy Carl Black duet.
So, oh yeah, Soul and Cadillac, of course.
That's a bit about.
I wrote that when I did a lot of guest spots in the 80s in LA. A friend of mine had a Western swing band, and Western swing being, of course, like when you get a bunch of like cowboys trying to do jazz, you get Western swing, and it's, I love that kind of music because it's like white guys trying to play jazz on string band instruments like you'd find in a country band. And I've always just loved that, you know, and it's just my favorite kind of music in a lot of ways. And I was playing a lot with this band at the time. They were pretty bad, I got to tell you, but they worked a lot. And it helped me get my chops back up at a time when I needed to in that kind of music. And I wrote Soul and Cadillac kind of to perform with them. So Jimmy, for some reason, had heard the song. John and I did a demo of it, as I recall.
Yeah, we did.
And someone had asked, you know, hey, you know, is another connection. Another person said, maybe Jimmy would like to do this. And we had met him at Zappanall, and we had performed, actually, go back a little bit. He and Candy had performed the song at Zappanall because he liked it when he heard it. And it was kind of bad because we didn't have enough rehearsal time, and it was kind of a pain in the butt. But they did this really funny version of it, and we were cracking up. And after that, Jimmy was on me like a, you know, a duck on a June bug. He's going, I've got to do this song. I want to record it. I want to record it. And I'm going, you know, what I didn't realize is at the time was that he was very ill. And he was looking at his legacy, I suppose. And so I said, well, okay. But I wasn't in really any position at the time to really do much because I wasn't set up. I didn't have a studio. It was in between time for me in the 90s, you know, the later 90s, early aughts. And anyway, point being, we ended up doing the song with him. John and I generated some tracks. And then he and Candy, he recorded his vocal. He was on his deathbed, I think, at the time. He died like months later. He did his vocal. Candy added her vocal in L.A. He recorded his in Italy. She did hers in L.A. We added, and then I got some of the old crew that played in that Western swing band to add fiddle and other parts. My friend Jay Rosen, the world's greatest tuba player, played a tuba part. And we threw that in there, and that was it. So it sat in the can for a long time, probably unreleased. But, you know, because it was Jimmy's last track, it was literally the last thing recorded before he passed away, I really wanted to get it out there just so people would know. He liked the song for some reason. I mean, it's not about me. This is not about me. I mean, I really was kind of uncomfortable with the whole thing. I'm going, well, I don't think this is the greatest song I ever wrote or anything. It's just like a, you know, it's sort of like Merle Haggard. It's like the Bakersfield sound. It's Western swing. It's like, you know, it's not something that I'm doing anymore. But Jimmy wanted to do it, and his will kind of predominated, and so we did it. And I'm really glad we did, actually. I'm just really glad for him. Mm-hmm. So we included it, of course, in his memory.
It's the other side of Randsburg. There's a place I know too well. There's a joint called Murphy's Last Chance, made Murphy rotten hell. All the laid-off defense workers go to hoist a course or two and swap their hard look stories, cause there's nothing else to do. Last night my boyfriend left me, just went slamming out the door. So I stumbled down to Murphy's, I was really feeling sore.
That's when I found her, she was falling off her chair. Glasses on the table and a ribbon in her hair.
Oh, if I ever make it out of Winnemucca, I swear to God I'm never going back. I'll stay the hell away from Murphy's Last Chance Roadhouse, and I'll never steal another Cadillac.
The one thing led to another. We talked till we was hoarse. I told her about my layoff and my miserable divorce.
Can't say that I remember when they hollered closing time, but by then the only question seemed to be your place and mine.
Oh, we staggered out the doorway. We was drunk enough to kill. I was looking for my pickup when I spied that Coupe de Ville. I grabbed my rusty Slim Jim and I got it in the door. Before that jerk could stop us, I had the pedal to the floor.
Oh, if I ever make it out of Winnemucca, I swear to God I'm never going back. I'll stay the hell away from Murphy's Last Chance Roadhouse, and I'll never steal another Cadillac.
Chapel, I think the preacher's name was Heck. I was barely standing upright as you wrote that rubber check.
I mumbled something stupid. He joined us two as one.
And if you ask me, darling, I'd say the honeymoon was done.
Oh, if I ever make it out of Winnemucca, I swear to God I'm never going back. I'll stay the hell away from Murphy's Last Chance Roadhouse, and I'll never steal another Cadillac.
Tell us about the sketch on the cover, the new
Well, that was...
Yes, the infamous sketch.
The infamous Beefheart sketch.
It's classic.
Beefheart. 1970. The end of 1970.
Which I, well, it's in Being Frank, isn't it?
Is that sketch
in Being Frank? Yes,
it is. Yeah, it is. It's actually, I feel like I'm the Playboy centerfold because the staple's right in my navel. it's a double truck. But, yeah. Keep on track. Yeah, Don drew that in, I believe it was December 1970. I had him at the time. Yeah.
Look, it says one of Captain Beefheart's portraits.
Yeah, well, he did many. He did many.
Lying in the dark with the sheep half on. Intoxication, titillation. I think of you and I'm almost gone. With titillation, I'm slumped over like this. Intoxication, just a pillow to kiss. I can't take anymore, I'm gonna lock the door and I'll give in to titillation. Hugging myself the way you sometimes do. Intoxication, titillation. You got me even though I can't get hold of you. Titillation, I got itchy fingers. Intoxication, the vision lingers. Can't take any more, I'm gonna lock the door and I'll give in to titillation.
fish. I'm gonna get arrested for these things that I think. Intoxication, titillation. I'd be alright if I had a dream. It's titillation, ain't no more I can say. Intoxication, it's night or it's day. Can't take anymore, I'm gonna beat down your door and we'll give in.
Yeah. Number, well,
street with no name, right?
These guys really, do they really want to know? Okay.
Well, it's really interesting.
Let me do it quickly.
It's got junk in it.
It's a lot
of stuff going
well,
on.
Well, I'm not a druggy person. I like a drink or two. That's about it. But when I was in the hospital with my cancer treatment, I was on a really heavy morphine drip, and that's heroin, basically.
Mm-hmm.
And I never be a heroin addict, but I went into this sort of twilight world where I couldn't tell the difference. Like a heroin addict, you know, you can't really tell the difference between reality and, you know, what's going on in your subconscious. And these lyrics and this whole scenario came to me about this. Well, yeah, I was working for a catalog company and writing copy, but that's another story. But, you know, it just was really interesting because I didn't know where I was. I was in this twilight world. And when I kind of came out of it, because I didn't like being on the morphine drip, I said, take me off this. I'm going to hurt. I don't care. It didn't make me feel too good. I started writing down the lyrics, and they didn't make any sense. And I go, you know what? It is sort of a street without a name. Calle sin nombre means street without a name in Spanish.
Hmm.
And I was thinking about, you know, that weird sort of mental state that I was in. But it's also, there's a book called Under the Volcano by an author named Malcolm Lowry. And he was like in a very twilight state in the right at the sort of time the Nazis were coming into power in Europe. And he was in Mexico. He's a British guy. He put himself in this novel in this role of being sort of this weird expatriate who was like looking down this literally into the cone of this volcano in Mexico where he was living. And his whole life was going to pieces and history was going to pieces. And I felt something about it. And there was the last line of that novel is someone threw a dead dog after him down the ravine. And John picked up on that. He didn't know the book, he didn't know the line or anything. But he's got garbage going down the hill. He's got sounds.
Makes sense.
It freaked me out. It's like a movie. It was just such an incredible movie, you know, by the time John got done with those effects. We added a lot of that stuff later.
Yeah.
But it's just pretty weird how, for me, okay, God, I'm going to get pretentious here, boys. I really apologize. There's all these levels of, for me, there's these levels of consciousness. I'm not a druggy person. I've never been into drugs. I love music. I like a few drinks. I like, you know, this or that. But it's literature, maybe. You just start to realize music has the potential to be so far beyond reality most people understand. It's beyond words. I love words a lot, too. I'm a writer, you know, translator, you know, linguist a bit. But I love words, but I love music because it's the closest we're ever going to get to the infinite in this consciousness.
Mm.
It's beyond the words.
Vibration,
and
yeah.
The vibrations and the levels of
the big note.
The big note, yeah.
Big note.
And what I've always wanted to try and do with my music, and I'm just getting closer to it, and John has helped me tremendously with this, I have to say, is to be able to find those levels and to put them out there in such a way that someone can hear them all at once. You know?
Yeah.
And that was that song of all of them on the album, it's one of the ones I thought was more successful with that.
Yeah. Okay. That was an interesting thing.
Yeah, it was.
Cashing your debenture, overcoat in hand, looking for adventure in a foreign land. Yellow dogs are howling on a rugged piece of rock. In the twilight, big cats growling, but dead men never talk. Trade winds blowing. on shore. There's no knowing what happens when you walk beyond the door. Now Jake's looking sulky back in the corner booth. Too much lukewarm pokey, not enough vermouth. Too spun to catch the tip off, and it's private kinda hell. In the afternoon, the ripoff. Forget the show and tell. Cold sweat flowing, pushing all your inhibitions sound. Dark fear growing, suddenly you taste it in your mouth. This archipelago is not on any map. It takes amnesia to free you from the trap. Now Blind Hans, he's got the ticket, gonna sell it for a song. It's quite a sticky wicket, haven't got that long. Moving on, play, and thank you just the same. Kai sing on, play, the stream without a name. New galoshes, suddenly you'd wish you'd made your will. Washes, sweeping all the garbage down the hill.
About the, yes. We touched on this a little bit earlier, but I was going to ask about the Pirates of Old Northport.
I was afraid of that.
Tell us about it.
Oh, God. Well, everybody I know wants to be a pirate. Maybe not Sean. Do you want to be a pirate?
I don't think much about it. I know my friend Susan does. Keith Richards does.
John's best friend, Keith Richards. Yeah. He is a pirate. What do you mean? When I moved to Long Island, in 2000, I'd been here before. My husband, Eric Weaver, used to hang out with a real great gang of derelicts when he's from here. It's a great gang of derelicts. They were, you know, Big Mike Kerr, the one-legged scourge of the North Shore, and all these other sort of really shady, sleazy characters. And, you know, it went way back, and I began to realize there's a real history here. You know, you think of pirates as something you read in a kid's book or a Disney movie or... You know, it's like, talk like a pirate, Jay, but there really are kind of pirates. People that are politically piratical. Sure. There's people that are socially piratical. And Frank, certainly, and Don struck me as the two earliest pirates that I knew in a lot of ways. They were pirates, in their way. I mean, look at that song they did, Orange Claw Hammer.
Yeah, right, exactly. A little shanty.
But anyway, it's the rum talking. Anyway, so I wanted to do this song, and I had written it actually when I was in the hospital recovering from my cancer. And somehow I had been talking to Eric, and we had met Mike and his friend here in Northport, but I was back in L.A., and I was thinking about all this stuff, and I'm going, well, how do you hijack life from the jaws of death? And, you know, how do you do this? What shift do I use? And it was very interesting. It was like a little bit like Highest Number. It's interesting you would put those two together. It's a lot of the stuff on this album, I think, has a geographical bent. It's the mental geography. It's your interior geography, but it's there. And so Eric and Mike and these guys used to run around the North Shore of Long Island here, in the early 70s. And there are all these guys, they go to bars and they, you know, they drink too much. And they lived on a boat, the Magdalena, which Mike had named after. And, you know, the dinghy was called the Mud Shark, for obvious reasons. And these guys were just like, you know, they were just like really, what can you say, they were dissolute. So, you know, I talked to them, I wrote the song, and it's just like, it was like a little piece of folklore, really.
This is bringing us up to Billy the Mountain.
So it is. Good. We're getting there. I'm sorry, I'll speed it up.
No,
so, anyway, yeah. So, these guys used to go up and down Main Street in Northport, okay, singing Billy the Mountain, a cappella, in its totality. They didn't.
Ow.
When I met Eric in L.A., my husband, he knew every word to Billy the Mountain. Every word to Billy the Mountain. This was in, what was that, 1992? Yeah. And he's going, you know all those words still? My God, I didn't know them when I had to actually sing them. And so it was like, oh my God, this is amazing. And I began to realize there's a big tradition with Billy the Mountain, especially here on the North Shore, a lot of people. John, there would be, I don't think John would be here today ruining his life if it wasn't for Billy the Mountain.
That's probably true.
Yeah. He's another one. And I began to talk to, you know, and so anyway, it came, it's just this whole thing. It began to kind of like, it coalesced. That's all I can say. It's all part of the same thing.
Mm.
All these guys on the North Shore who love Billy the Mountain and they're pirates and, you know, how do we hijack life? And I got back to myself here, lying in that hospital bed. I'm going, I'm going to hijack life, by golly, you know. I don't remember the words to Billy the Mountain, God forbid, but, you know, I love this stuff. And that's where it came from. And so we went into the studio and did it. And it was funny that we had...
Actually, Nigel gave me a demo of it.
Yeah, a demo of it.
And I tried different versions of it. And,
you just did it with guitar.
With a guitar, and one with the bass kept changing every kind of the chorus and stuff. And it really wasn't... That was like the only one where she was like, nah, that's really not what I want. I really want to have people together.
Get a gang. So that,
that's what we did in Los Angeles. We got a lot of people together.
Yeah, we got the crew.
And they did it live. And I was like, you know, these guys are like getting drunk. I'm like, whatever. And I'm naturally thinking, we're never going to get this done. It's never going to happen.
I know. Well, yeah.
But in fact, the more everybody
the drunker they got, the better it got.
It got better.
It really was shit.
Like, I didn't even know how to approach it. I'm like, these guys know what they're doing.
Yeah, they did. And they were all drunk, but it was great. Yeah. So, and then we got Keneally.
Yeah, Keneally
to do
got
his part
in.
Too. Mm-hmm. Yeah, he wasn't there when we recorded the other guys, but we added him later. But yeah, it really worked out. It was kind of funny because one of the guys that does Steve Lowe he's no longer above the sod. He passed. And it's like, it's one of those things, you know, it's just like, you realize time kind of flies, and it's like, we're talking about the 70s, we're talking about the aughts, we're talking about now.
We're saying more and more about the past.
Oh, yeah.
So it's like, that's just going to have normal for everybody, I guess, every generation.
Yeah.
It's funny.
It's like, it's about escape.
But people like that record a lot.
I know. It was stolen out of the jukebox at Gunther's on Northport. Yeah, Little Roar 2, Gunther's Bar. You know, Gunther's Bar, that was...
It's a real place.
Yeah, it is a real place. Kerouac used to drink there. But anyway, yeah, the disc, we had a burned copy of it. It was stolen out of the jukebox.
We've always had, if you will, old Pirates of Old Northport. And some, like Denny the Rat Teal and the Bush Boys and... they're still out there someplace, swinging things. Lobsters, pieces of plastic.
You mean those ones upstairs in your house? Yeah.
Swinging lobsters and pieces of plastic.
It's a damn good ship with a damn good crew.
Late at night at Drifter's Reef, honest John will come to grief should he attempt to stop our sport. We are the Pirates of Bully Boys all. We are the Pirates of Old Northport. Say hey-ho, watch us blow Stony Brook to the old branch. Oh, we'll make them flee by land or sea. We are the Pirates, Bully Boys all. We are the Pirates of Old Northport.
Oh, down we'll roar to Gunther's bar. Some of us in Big Mike's car will drink 'em dry and hold rough course. We are the pirates, bully boys all. We are the pirates of Old Northport.
Sing hey ho, watch us blow Stony Brook to the old branch show. We'll make 'em free by land or sea. We are the pirates, bully boys all. We are the pirates of Old Northport.
Oh, the Magdalena, she's our ship. The Mudshark is our leaking skiff. And upon deck we'll take a snore. We are the pirates, bully boys all. We are the pirates of Old Northport.
So hey ho, watch us blow Stony Brook to the old branch show. We'll make 'em flee by land or sea. We are the pirates, bully boys all. We are the pirates of Old Northport.
Oh, once around Block Island Sound, we'll cruise the straits down to Smithtown. At Ashoroken, there's our fort. We are the pirates, bully boys all. We are the pirates of Old Northport.
So hey ho, watch us blow from Stony Brook to the old Rancho. We'll make 'em flee by land or sea. We are the pirates, bully boys all. We are the pirates of Old Northport.
Some of that was okay.
Anyway, yeah, who cares? 90s. It's just, yeah, okay. Pirate!
Doesn't that take us to the future? Isn't that,
hopefully, is pirates.
That album of sea shanties and stuff?
What's going on with that? Well, there's a lot going on with us. Both of us. John, okay, John has, I'll let John tell you about it. John is doing projects, also for Muffin Records. He's going to be new release.
Yeah, I'm not really sure what it is. I have a new bunch of music that I'm putting together, but, you know, unfortunately, the way CDs work nowadays, people seem to be more interested in picking and choosing, and that's unfortunate for me because I like to have a certain continuity between the discs and where the songs go in the order, and I guess that's just for our generation. Maybe the newer generation, who knows, they just pick and choose.
Well, they have a really short attention span. They just want to hear 3 minutes at a time, you know. We really run it for the long haul. Off on the long view, but hey,
we'll see what happens with that. You know, I'll give him a little bit of, in order to get people interested, sometimes you have to give them a little bit of control, a little bit. Like, I'll say, here's 600 songs. Which ones do you want to make? Which ones do you want to choose?
600. That's a little. What kind of control have you got over that?
Well, I'm just saying, if it inspires someone, because then they're going to feel better about trying to promote it because they're part of it.
Yeah.
You know, that's the problem when you know and you have control over everything. People are like, well, they already know what they're doing, so they don't bother to help you. So if you give people a little bit of a choice, it's like, here, why don't you get more involved with it? I think that's what we're going to probably do. So who knows? Yeah. That should be an interesting.
Yeah, so John's going to be there. We have other projects, John and myself. I'm working on, I'll start with, well, let's start with Ship in a Bottle.
Ship in a Bottle. That's a nice
I've been working on a project since we had, John, I had a studio in Centerport here on Long Island quite a few years ago, and you know that is a history now. But we started working on a thing together called Ship in a Bottle, which was at first it was sea shanties. I'm thinking of the pirate stuff because we're living right on the water, and you know it has that kind of vibe. But I started thinking I love these old modal things because, like I said before, my uncle was an old time fiddle player, and I love that sound. But I have a friend, Judith Aller, who is in Los Angeles, and she's a world class classical violinist. And she wants to work with me on stuff, and we've, you know, always worked really well together. So we started working on some stuff together. I wrote a song called Chip in a Bottle, which was sort of like, this is the story of my life, you know. My uncle was, like I said, an old-time fiddle player, and I loved those sort of, you know, modal, sort of folky things. But I liked the fact that you could throw some interesting changes in there. And I mean, I always liked groups like Fairport Convention and groups like that, because I love that modal thing. It's the Irish part of me, I guess. And anyway, or maybe it's a Scotch in me, too. But Anyway, so, you know, I started writing this song, and it was like my friend Judith Aller, I was saying, because he's a world-class violinist. She was Yasha Heifetz's only student. And we were working on stuff together, and John and I had the studio in Centerport at that time. And we started laying down tracks. We did Ship in a Bottle, and we did Derelict, which is actually an old, you know, 15 men on a dead man's chest. You know, it's that one. So we started working on that. And then I started writing more and more stuff, and it became a project, basically. And so it's, we're going to go on from there. I'd like to make it semi-acoustic. I'm reinventing the wheel is pretty much a studio effort. You know, we're dealing with keyboards, we're dealing with samples, we're dealing with parts pile up. It's, you know, it's very much, you know, cross-temporal transference. In a sense, there's nothing very much real time.
That's a great word.
Yeah, but you know, I was talking to John about it. There's so many beautiful things. Our, you know, indefatigable publicist Scott Pettis is a bass player and a singer and a hell of a songwriter and a great all around whatever. He's had a bunch of ideas. He wrote a song called "Dancing the Hempen Jig," which the hempen jig is when somebody strikes. Yeah, I bet Andrew's laughing there. He knows what it is. Hang you up on the yard arm, you know, on a noose, and you know, let you hang until buzzards pick your eyes up. Anyway, we've got all these songs, and you know, it's like we're going to be. Isn't that charming? Yeah, Christmas tune.
It's a real Christmas tune.
Yeah, right. Ravens plucking out your eyeballs.
Exactly.
Anyway, we're going to be doing this, I think, as my next album project, and I'm going to have Judith on violin, John on whatever, guitar, vocal. So we have to have John sing, because if I do it, no one's going to buy this record. And, you know, other people, Jay Rosen on tuba. I want to do some chamber music stuff too with French horn, English horn, hornpipe.
Yeah.
You know, whatever.
Oh, horny pipe.
Horny pipe. But, you know, I just kind of feel it. It's just something. I always like groups like, you know, Fairport Convention. I love Sandy Denny. I love her voice. Mm-hmm. And I love kind of that whole approach to kind of modernizing slightly, but keeping that quality and, you know, going from there. And so I don't know where it's going to lead, but that is going to be my next project. And I've talked to Reinhardt at Muffin about it. And, you know, he's announced it. And here we go. God forbid.
And once
you
put it out,
we're gonna do it.
Want to tell them a little bit about Willie the Hill before we get?
Oh well, that's the main point though, is Willie the Hill. Mm. Okay, John, would you like to?
Well, as you people out there that know,
in
Radio Land, of course, Billy the Mountain is a great story about a mountain that finally gets royalty checks and gets into all kinds of trouble. Just trying to see America. He gets into trouble. I don't have to go into detail because you know all about Billy the Mountain. But what happened to Billy the Mountain after?
After his denouement.
After his little stint with
Studebaker
Hawk.
Yeah,
what happened
to
him after that? Well,
we
found out what happened to him.
Yeah,
and that's why he's Willie the Hill.
Once a big old mountain, now
the
just
miss
you know
education
what?
Of
we
Willie
should
the
send
Hill.
Them the tracks. You want to put a little bit of it on this podcast?
Yeah. Yeah,
okay. Yeah, we have a demo.
We have demos. It's not going to be the finished version, but
it's pretty funny.
It's funny.
Definitely, it's about, you know, it's a.
And so we've been in conversation. Heavy duty Eddie Sincere promo agent vlogger, who's been who's been abusing Coda Cloud, you know, the Netherlands, who's the big honcho at Radio 6, and has recently promoted major concerts with Mike Keneally and George Duke and a lot of other people over there. That have done very well. Anyway, he's talking to us. I mean, I think what it is like we want to do this with Ed Palermo's big band.
Yeah.
Well, John and I love working with Ed. And
designed
Ed,
it sort of
Ed would love working with us if we paid him enough.
financial thing. Ed, well, he needs to get paid.
He needs to get paid, and so do we, as a matter of fact. But we, you know, we're pretty good at living
we've
by
got
our
a lot of the work done already. That, you know,
we're
we
witty
have,
people. We can live by our wits. But anyway, you know, so we're working on this, and we're trying to get sort of, we're sitting down at either sides of the negotiating table at this point, so I don't know where it's going to end up, but we're keeping our fingers crossed. This might be, Andrew, you might have to put something in your blog about this, you know, reasonably soon, and if not, well.
Yeah, somebody will read it like Dweezil and they'll want to take the idea, but we've already done the idea.
It's too late. We'll be right back.
And there you have it. Andrew and I would like to thank Nigel Lennon and John Tobacco for coming on to the show. As you can hear, a very good time was had by all. And we're going to close out this episode with a track that takes us back in time to 2002 and the Zappanal 13 Festival. This track is 50-50, performed by Nigel Lennon, John Tobacco, and Candy Zappa with Ed Palermo and Ike Willis. I think you'll like this one. Thanks very much, boys and girls, and we'll see you next time.
We've got some of the greatest audio techs in the world. I mean, who else can say they have Ike Willis fixing their amps, man? Thank you, Ike.
Well, something's wrong with that amp there, darling.
Amp fish.
Okay. What do you do? To say to you, any old way, hey, I figure the odds may be 50-50. I just might have something to say.
to say to you any old way.
Thank you.
That's our show. Thank you very much for listening. The Zappacast was produced and edited by Scott Parker, Andrew Greenaway, and Mick Eakers. Be sure to check out Andrew's website at www.idiotbastard.com for all the latest Zappa news, and also to purchase Andrew's book, Zappa the Hard Way, the definitive account of the 1988 Frank Zappa Broadway the Hard Way tour. For those of you interested in obtaining my Zappa books, my website is located at www.spbpublishing.webs.com. And if you order the books directly from me, I'll sign them for you. My books are also available from www.gndsmusic.com, purveyors of the finest Zappa merchandise anywhere, as well as www.amazon.com and many other right-thinking booksellers. And you should also check out Mick Eaker's excellent site on Frank's gear at www.zappasgear.com. And for more information about Scott Fisher, you can go to fishersflicker.com. That's F-I-S-C-H-E-R-S. FLICKER.com. Scott is a very wonderful musician and songwriter, and you can check out some of his music at that website. If you wish to contact us, drop us a line at MOI1969, that's 1969, at SNET.net. On behalf of Andrew Greenaway and Mick Eakers, this is Scott Parker saying thank you again for listening. And until next time, good night, boys and girls.
Thanks a lot. Good night.